Capital Investment Committee for January 28th is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01. It's being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Members, please remember that all discussion will be through the chair. And for those seeking recognition, please use the raise hand function. And if you have issues, please contact Ms. Jenny Nash or Mr. Joe Lincheski. With that, Joe Lincheski, please take the quorum. Roll call.
Members, you may unmute yourself when your name is called. Representative Fu Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Fu Lee, present. Representative Mary Murphy.
Murphy, present.
Representative Mary Murphy, present. Representative Dean Erdahl.
Erdahl, present.
Representative Dean Erdahl, present. Representative Esther Abadje.
Abadje, present.
Representative Esther Abadje, present. Representative Kayla Berg.
Present.
Representative Kayla Berg, present. Representative Greg Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Greg Davids, present. Representative Keith Franke.
Franke, present.
Representative Keith Franke, present. Representative Mike Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Mike Freiberg, present. Representative Rick Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Representative Rick Hansen, present. Representative John Hewitt.
Hewitt, present.
Representative John Hewitt, present. Representative Leon Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Leon Lilly, present. Representative Eric Lucero.
Happy National Blueberry Pancake Day.
All right.
Representative Eric Lucero, present. Representative Rena Moran.
Moran, present.
Representative Rena Moran, present. Representative Nels Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Nels Pearson, present. Representative Donald Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Donald Raleigh, present. Representative Jordan Rasmussen.
Present.
Representative Jordan Rasmussen, present. Representative Liz Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Representative Liz Ryer, present. Representative Nolan West. Representative Nolan West. Representative Jay Zhang.
Here.
Representative Jay Zhang, present. Representative Nolan West. Members, with the conclusion of the roll call, please mute your devices. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Ms. Lincheski. A quorum is present. Representative Murphy, can I have a motion to approve the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move to approve the minutes for January 26th.
Representative Murphy, move approval of the minutes for January 26th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for January 26th are approved. So members, today's hearing is following up on Dr. Corey's testimony on Tuesday on the economic cost of racism. Today's presentation will identify building blocks for equity and how to consider a project's impact on the Black, Indigenous, and people of color or BIPOC community and other disadvantaged communities across the state. We will begin with C.T. Anderson, the director from the community-based research programs at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Anderson, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Right on. Good morning, everybody. My name is C. Terrence Anderson, Director of Community-Based Research and Community Programs at the Center for Urban and Regional Affairs, or CURA, at the University of Minnesota. Thank you so much, Chair Lee and members and representatives for allowing me to present today along with the others. I think we're going to have some fun. You may hear my kids. This is work from home life in the back, just letting you know. So I apologize for that up front, but hopefully we'll get through it. Anyways, I think I'm going to share a screen and roll from there. So let's see. All right, hopefully everybody can see that. So the chair asked me to come and present today about what does equitable development of infrastructure, what might that look like? What would an equitable bonding bill look like potentially in the future? So just sharing some thoughts from our own research at CURA about, you know, sort of our lessons learned in our different research and collaborations, both with governments and with community organizations throughout the state. Hopefully I'll be able to use some illustrative examples to talk about sort of the different points or, you know, principles that we're sort of operating with We'll mainly focus a lot of these examples in the Twin Cities Metro, but we also do work around the state that we'll sort of talk about. I'll talk about as well as I move through that, knowing that y'all are from not just the Twin Cities area. So going forward, I always like to start presentations about this, sort of putting this person's face forward. Usually when I talk about this in broader groups, I ask, well, does anybody know who this is? But, you know, knowing that this is sort of a Zoomer and it's kind of awkward. This is a person who's had a lot of power in history, shaping the way that we build infrastructure, particularly transportation infrastructure, you know, throughout the country. This is the person that sort of modeled building freeways throughout, you know, through cities in the early, you know, or the mid 20th century, and really shaped a lot of the sort of present equity challenges that we have today. So, for example, in Rondo, building the freeway through that community, building, you know, 94 through that community is really a legacy of something that this person pioneered in New York City and in the mid 20th century. And so I bring up this person because I sort of, we think about him in the context of, hey, we build inequitable infrastructure where we sort of follow this model. This was somebody who at one point said, you know, what if people of New York City don't want for you to do what they do? And he responded, well, it doesn't matter because I hold the, you know, because it's my decision anyway. At one point, he held 26 positions. I think it was 26 positions and controlled all the federal money going into New York City and decided, you know, to do all this, you know, really, I think what we today say is really inequitable work that led to a lot of present challenges. And so I bring this up because equity is about responding to history as we sort of decided and talk about it at Cura. So our racial equity framework, I just really want to get on the same page of what do I mean when I'm talking about equity? I think there's a lot of different definitions. I'm sure if I went throughout the committee today and asked, you know, what's your definition of racial equity, we'd probably get a whole lot of different answers. And so it's really just to center on what I mean by racial equity. You know, Cura, we talk about it as this. Racial equity work is contextualized, it's community-centered, and it's reparative. Contextualized in the sense that we mean when we do racial equity work, we're responding to something that's happening in the past or something that's happening structurally or systemically today. So, for example, sort of sometimes when I say this in a non-academic way, I would say if you were trying to get to my house from wherever you are at right now, and say you went to Google Maps and say, "Hey, I want to get to North Minneapolis. I think I live right around the corner from Chair Lee. We're not too far from each other." And you're trying to get to, you know, our place in Falwell in Minneapolis. You know, you put my address into Google Maps, and then Google Maps would say, "Well, where are you coming from?" If you didn't put an address into Google Maps would say, "Well, I can't help you with that." Right? We need to know where we're coming from to know which direction we need to head towards the future. So if you say to me, "I just want to make equity my work more equitable," I would say, "What are you responding to?" And if you had no answer for that, I would say, "Well, equity work is going to be really hard to do in that case." So we need to contextualize our work. We need to know where we're starting from to really get a clear picture about what direction we're heading from or heading toward in the future. Secondly, I'd say equity work is community centered. It's centering the people who are harmed in that history of inequity. So sometimes I'd say is, you know, if I hurt you as an individual, who gets to decide between the two of us what healing looks like for you? Most people would say the person that was harmed is the person who needs to be the most significant in the context of what healing looks like. So thinking about that in the context of infrastructure, knowing that sometimes infrastructure has harmed people, right? Thinking about I-94 through Rondo as a very significant example, but there's examples throughout the state about what harm as a result of legacy infrastructure looks like. How do we center those communities to be sort of the most powerful force and vision for what, you know, a healed, a repaired future looks like? And so that's, I think that's a really important point when we're talking about racial equity, and putting the people who are harmed in the center and the creators of their own healing. Third, equity is reparative. So we're ensuring that these solutions are equal to what caused the inequity in the first place. So my sort of, you know, little colloquial joke about that is, you know, if you had a car and say you really, really loved this car, and I took that car and I lit it on fire and I pushed it into the Mississippi River, I'm sure a lot of you would be really upset about that. And, you know, as a person that teaches ethics, I'd realize what I did was wrong. And then so I came back a year later and I said, hey, I want to make this right. Here's a new pair of shoes. You'd be like, that's not good enough. A pair of shoes for a car is not enough. I think we need to think similarly when we're talking about equity work in the future. It's not just about sort of paying some sort of homage and acknowledging this harm. It's sort of repairing that harm fully in the context of what happened in the first place, right? What is a car for a car? Or I was a transit planner for a long time. So what is a car for a really good bus system look like or something like that, right? Something that's equal, that delivers sort of the same well-being that was lost in the inequity in the first place. So hopefully those are some illustrated examples. I'll sort of keep talking about what I mean by those things that sort of remain sort of esoteric in this sense, but just talk about how I've seen that happen in my career and in the research that we've done at Kira. So starting with that contextualization work, a lot of what Kira does is we start with where did a lot of this happen? Now, this is the city of Minneapolis. You can see sort of North Minneapolis on the left. You can see Northeast Minneapolis on the right and South Minneapolis on the bottom. This is a redlining map, I believe from the 1930s. It's kind of interesting redlining. I don't know how much everybody knows about redlining, but that was sort of the practices by realtors and governments and banking institutions to sort of decide where are the, you know, the areas that one where white folks could live and people of color could not, but also where the places that would be worthy of being invested in and where they would not. It's actually a little bit backward. The red is sort of the so-described worst areas, the yellow to blue to green are the best. And so you can just sort of see a little map of that today or what that looked like in the 1930s. Next slide shows the foreclosure crisis overlaid with it along with market value on the right. So you can sort of see the way we don't really need to do a correlation analysis to see where there were significant foreclosures in the 2008 to 2011 foreclosure crisis, as well as where market value, right? That legacy, that history, we can see it today. Again, the 1934 Hope redlining map showed on the right. This shows Minneapolis' top 11 highest areas of need that show a bunch of different factors, right? We don't need to do a correlation analysis to see that history as it sort of shows up for us today. The point is, I'm trying to show the way contextualization of historic infrastructures still are legacy and sort of play a role in the paradigms that we sort of are trying to address today, right? So that showing the importance of that contextualization work about how we can sort of paint a future like, okay, what do we need to address, right? If you're looking at these maps, we know we need to do something around housing in these legacy redlined communities. If I sort of overlay these same maps with along I-94, which some might be familiar, the way it runs from North Minneapolis through downtown over to St. Paul, where you guys would have been if it wasn't a pandemic. And you'd see that along I-94, there's higher rates of asthma, higher rates of cancer, all these other environmental justice issues that sort of play a role in these legacy infrastructures, right? So it's not just housing. We see these repeated in environmental justice considerations. We see the same things in transportation considerations, right? So where are the jobs? Where do sort of our transportation systems get people to get out to the jobs? What are the sort of the opportunities that sort of are surrounded by those things, right? Those are legacy things that we're still sort of trying to address in a lot of different ways. So, today, I'm just once again, just focusing on Minneapolis, but of course, this just sort of illustrative of these points. But these are sort of the same things that we're experiencing around this state. Here we sort of, this is something that we did a couple years ago, showing sort of the affordability. Year 2000 up top, year 2014 on the bottom. We have Black or African-American folks, then Hispanic or Latino folks in the middle, then white non-Hispanic folks on the far right. The green areas are where is affordable based off of them spending, 30% of their income on their rent or mortgages. So already Minneapolis wasn't an affordable city for most Black or African-American folks. Now today there is no place in Minneapolis in which the average Black or African-American person is paying what we'd say an affordable rent or mortgage. That doesn't mean that there aren't some, we're just talking about on average. and can sort of see the way that that's decreasing for other groups as well. This pairs with sort of these broad trends, or let me just go back to this slide. These broad trends about affordability that we're seeing experience around the state, you know, people's incomes are being squeezed, right? We're seeing a lot of stagnated wages, sort of a way that we, you know, decrease dollars pouring into affordable housing, rising property taxes, all these different sort of things play a role in this for just about every group. And it's, of course, you know, it's even more, this trend has continued even into 2021, if I was to sort of create the same map today. So these legacy inequities from historic infrastructure, I think, bring up a couple of things, right? A variety of environmental justice issues to talk about, right? So air quality, water quality, issues that are around the state that play a role, that these legacy infrastructures have played a role in perpetuating. Access to opportunity is inequitable. So we're talking about access to jobs and leisure and all these different sort of things, right? It's different in North Minneapolis than it is in South Minneapolis when we're talking about these things. The times to get to places are different around the state, right? For some communities, getting from one community to the next community, you have to go all the way around just because of the way that we built you know, our infrastructure in the past. So, right, this access of opportunity is inequitable, not just in the Twin Cities, but around the state. There's distrust of infrastructure projects today from the perspective of these historically marginalized communities. And when I say that, of course, I mean, yes, people of color, but I also mean in rural communities. We're talking about, you know, elderly folks, and we're talking about a lot of community people who are marginalized in a lot of different ways. Right, there's distrust. I think probably you've all have experienced this. You go to your community and say, hey, we're going to do this. We're really excited about this. And then you show up to that public meeting and not everybody's really excited about it. In fact, everybody's really skeptical that this is going to be a good thing. You know, I worked on the Sea Line project in Minneapolis, which I think is a great project. Sea Line, Sea Terrence, there might be a connection, right? But I remember, you know, working in North Minneapolis, the only community that I live in, saying, hey, this is going to be a really great thing. And how many times I really had to prove that it was going to be a good thing. And I think that's a legacy of the way that a lot of these projects happened, right? We have to be sort of responsive to people sort of feeling that a lot of this stuff happened to them, not happened with them. And so then when we come and talk about these projects, they think something else might be happening to them rather than happening with them. And that makes our work more difficult, makes our work more expensive. And at the end of the day, I think that planning ultimately is a sociological sort of thing more than it is an engineering project. And we have to sort of view it as such in order to sort of address some of the distrust that exists around the state in response to that. I think at times we really need to, we sort of need to rethink what we call the proximity model. So if we're talking about oftentimes people in the community that I live in, North Minneapolis, we sort of view success as, well, how can we get them to move to more prosperous areas in the suburbs, rather than viewing it as how do we invest in communities like North Minneapolis around the state so that those are prosperous places too, right? Thinking about the legacy of disinvestment in redline areas and other disinvested areas around the state, it isn't just we want to move those people to where we have invested in, right? How do we invest into a system of infrastructure that creates prosperity in areas that we haven't historically seen it? And we need to sort of, you know, we also know that, you know, infrastructure is built outside of efficiency is expensive to maintain. I'm sure as y'all are deciding on a bonding bill every year, you sort of struggle with the amount it takes to sustain this system is more expensive, it costs more than dollars that y'all have to decide on, right? And that's sort of the disbursement, the sort of the inefficiency of the system is something that I'm sure that y'all really have to struggle with. And so that's going to be a compounding problem when we're talking about addressing inequity and sort of disparate, you know, disparities in prosperity around the state and into historically marginalized and disinvested areas. So this next slide is sort of illustrative about, you know, so how are we trying to address this today? This slide sort of overlays where we see, this is North Minneapolis again, it's just a place I'm really familiar with, but we also probably familiar with this around the state. About sort of, we have green zones, we have areas of concentrated poverty or ACP 50s, we have opportunity zones, we have promise zones, right? All these layers of federal and state policy and city policy and county policy that sort of overlays over these districts that are really hard for community to really understand and to really know what are all the different compounding forces about how to sort of address inequity. And we sort of also need to think about, this comes from Kira's gentrification study from a couple of years ago, updated in 2019, that overlays major infrastructure projects like rail lines and BRT lines, as well as some stadiums and Upper Harbor Terminal, which maybe y'all have talked about as well, overlaid with where is gentrification and happening around. So where are people sort of being displaced from their homes, typically poor people of color. And we sort of see this relationship, right? We might even argue that, hey, we are investing, we have this equitable infrastructure plan. Also remembering that, you know, if you are building the sea line through North Minneapolis, which is on the top left, white people in those community were like, it's quite curious that you're investing in this at the same time we're being displaced from this, right? So it's a complicated thing to do if not done well, if not in collaboration with those historically marginalized communities, that there are these sort of these externalities, as we would say, to invest in these places from an infrastructure perspective. So how do you sort of have a holistic approach to doing infrastructure development that's not just putting a rail line in there, but recognizing that that's going to affect housing, that's going to affect the sort of the environmental conditions we might want to co-address some of these things at the same time in order to sort of mitigate the negative externalities that come out of these, what we might call equitable infrastructure projects. So these trends shaping our future, Minneapolis, and I think it's supposed to say St. Paul, is becoming increasingly unaffordable for BIPOC residents. The region, the state is becoming increasingly diverse. Disparities, especially poverty, are increasingly visible. It's actually, there's more poverty in the suburbs of the metro area than there is in the two twin cities themselves, right? And we sort of see, you know, this summer, you know, encampments around Minneapolis and in other places, it's increasingly visible, exacerbated by the present pandemic and subsequent economic decline. So evidence suggests that income inequality is on the rise, suggesting disparities may increase even further. I think that's proving to be true, especially in the context of the pandemic. Stagnant wages plus rising home prices, rent prices equals displacement. So why are we experiencing gentrification and displacement? So the demographic inversion, folks that were sort of lived their whole lives in the suburbs are moving into the cities. People of color are increasingly moving into the suburbs and into greater Minnesota. And, there's a rise in suburban poverty. Other trends, housing infrastructure issues continue to grow both inside and outside of the Twin Cities metro area. Kira, ourselves, were doing studies about the challenge of affordable housing around the state with other institutions and organizations in partnership with that exist on the reservations, that exist in St. Cloud and places beyond throughout the state. Legacy housing affordability programs are set to expire in the next 10 to 15 years. That's really gonna play a role around the state. Aging populations in rural areas will continue to grow and face challenges to travel to places they need to go, right? There's not a lot of transit infrastructure outside of the major cities of the state. Infrastructure and environmental harm is a growing area of study, and we're sort of still fully realizing the relationship between those two. And I think, Kira hopes to continue to invest in doing that work. A growing trend, renewable energy is unevenly distributed, and so are its benefits. And right, some of these communities sort of are taking on these natural gas and coal energy plants, and right, there's going to be, you know, air quality issues with that, as well as sort of the price benefits of being renewable energy tended to be in more wealthy communities versus non-wealthy communities. So we have to think about these trends as we're sort of thinking about what does an equitable infrastructure system look like.
So Mr. Anderson, we have a question for you from Representative Hewitt. Representative Hewitt,
Thank you, Chair. I can wait till he's finished if this is the question time.
We can take a question right now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. I don't know how to phrase this, and I'm concerned about
sure.
it.
Sure.
In what we're doing in investments and stuff, but what I notice, and I'm starting to see it as a trend, are we seeing, like, in zoning and planning and covenants with associations in the suburbs right now, that being some of the maybe new forms of redlining, where we're locking out certain individuals or certain economic classes, like even as far as going that you can only have maybe two chickens in the city of Rosemount. I have concerns about that, and it's really coming on my radar recently. I don't know if you've looked into this or studied it, but I'd like to hear more.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Lee and Rep. Hewitt. I think you're exactly right. Some of those laws and zoning policies or legacy policies that were, of course, were definitively intentionally created to keep certain folks out. And I think, you know, some of those things have expanded. I mean, we've seen challenges of getting affordable housing built in some suburban communities around the state and around, you know, the metro area. And yeah, the chicken law in Rosemount seemed to be clearly motivated to sort of control who's in and what they can do once they're there. And, you know, different laws we've seen, you know, in the western suburbs, some of our colleagues and partners in the western suburbs have studied some of the laws that allow people to get evicted, that, you know, things like they haven't committed a crime, but some crime exists, you know, it happened on the property where they can evict people. You know, if you sort of look at the legacy of some of those laws, were clearly meant to exclude different folks and different zoning, where you can do affordable housing, where you can't. Even conversations around, you know, transit, I've been a part of that people don't want transit to go out there because then it allows certain people to get out there. You know, at times it gets very explicit and a lot of times it's not too, but I think you're exactly right.
So on that, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Hewitt.
So that was the last part of my question there is that you have seen or at least flagged transit situations too, where limiting transit to the suburbs and beyond also has created some possibly inequitable or, again, situations that were keeping certain people out, right?
Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Chair Lee, Representative Hewitt. Yep, I think I saw quite a lot. I used to work at Metro Transit. I've worked at, you know, the Met Council and other places and in our own research at Kira. Absolutely. And there's a lot of ways that it shows up. It's not just building a line somewhere in the first place, but it's also sort of the travel times, right? If you're coming to North Minneapolis to get to Richfield without the blue line or something, it's much a longer travel time to get the jobs that might be down there. So it's not even just the access in the first, it's a compounding issue of access that I think needs to be addressed. But I think you're spot on.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, thanks a lot. And I just wanted to clarify, I don't think it's two chickens in Rosemount. It might be no goats. So I don't want my inbox full of emails today. So thank you very much.
Representative Lucero, last question on this presentation before we move on. Representative Lucero.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll wait till the end. That's fine.
Okay, thank you. And so, CT, Mr. Anderson, if you want to wrap up, you have about a minute left.
Okay, yeah, I will. Okay, I'll breeze through the last part of it. Sorry about that. I think there's a number of good projects to learn from that I've been really a big fan of. We did a capital improvement budget study in St. Paul that sort of looked at where do their capital improvement dollars go to around the city, see if there was an equal distribution or equitable distribution. We found that there wasn't. I think that was really important contextualization work that's helped the city of St. Paul sort of move forward in doing that work. I think of the Penn Avenue Community Works Project, which was a partnership between the Met Council, Metro Transit, City of Minneapolis, and Hennepin County, that not only just put the C line on the rep, but they also looked at housing-related dollars to keep people in the houses and do improvements around that, improve, you know, biking and other infrastructure, pedestrian infrastructure at the same time. So that compounding way of looking at things, I think, is really great. This is from the West End Route 9 Transit Study that I was a part of when I worked at Metro Transit. They looked at where there are jobs in the region that are paying $40,000 or less, and looking at the way that their service can sort of connect people there better. And so I think that contextualizing work and that sort of intentionality and having an analysis about what to address, I think is really important. And, you know, Metro Transit and Met Council, I'm a fan of a lot of the work they're doing in this context of developing infrastructure, connecting in a good way. So just last point that I was wrapping up, I think equity calls us to take the lead from marginalized communities, to develop a robust analysis about where disparities exist, where they come from, who specifically is harmed by them, and intentionally address those disparities. And that infrastructure and community development should go together, right? So it's not just putting in transit lines or doing, you know, housing-related dollars, but what happens around that, I think, leads to the best outcomes possible.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And then, Representative Erdog, is this a question for Mr. Anderson, or can you wait until the end?
This is for Mr. Anderson, but if you want me to wait till the end, that's fine.
Why don't you go ahead before we move on? Representative Erdog.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Anderson, first of all, the guy you showed us a picture of at the beginning, who was that?
Oh, did I not say the name? Robert Moses. Anderson. I'm sorry. That was probably my nervousness. That's all right. It was Robert. His name is Robert Moses. Great book about him called The Power Broker.
Representative Erdog.
Thank you. And also then, and maybe you were touching on this at the conclusion, but as far as the type of projects that we do, we do infrastructure, we do public buildings to obtain goals in equity that you are referring to. What types of projects do you think we should be doing? What would best address the need?
Mr. Anderson.
That's a great question. You know, I think what a lot of our research and collaborations with community and governments over the past couple of years would tell me is that housing is a really big one. Transportation, particularly transit projects, I think. And I think I would love to spend more time talking about the different types of transit projects, both in rural and urban areas, because I think both really matter. And energy projects, environmental projects that sort of address air quality and water quality concerns as well, I think are really, really important.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And so let's move to Ms. R.G. McNollis from the Center for Small Town. Maybe you can shed some light on some of the projects that Representative Erdog may be thinking of. So please introduce yourself for the record and please proceed, Ms. McNollis.
Sure. My name is R.G. McNollis. I'm the Director of Civic Learning and Engagement at the University of Minnesota Morris. I'm going to talk with you today about, I'm on the wrong slide. Sorry about that. Just real briefly, the University of Minnesota Morris is located in West Central Minnesota. We're a Native American serving non-tribal institution, and we have a very diverse student body, so that you know a little bit about us. I am the director of the Center for Small Towns. It's one of the units that I direct, and our mission is to work to connect UMN Morris assets, such as faculty expertise and student time and talent and other resources, to meet the needs in communities primarily of 10,000 residents or fewer, although we do work with some larger communities that are in rural areas as well. And one of our initiatives, sort of our signature initiatives that I think may be the reason I was asked to speak today, I'm not sure, is called the Morris Intercultural Education Initiative. We've been working since 2013 with immigrant communities, primarily in the Morris area, although starting in the fall, we'll be expanding some of our work beyond the Morris area to other small towns in Minnesota. So that's a little bit about me and what I do. I will say that I'm entering this this testimony with a lot of humility. I'm a white woman who's worked closely with immigrant communities and communities of color in rural Minnesota, but certainly do not intend to speak for them. I also will not be talking very much about Native American indigenous communities, not because it's not important, but because the way that indigenous communities are organized are quite different. So I'm thinking about small towns that have been primarily white for many, many, you know, decades, centuries, and are now seeing an influx of people of color. So these are the key questions that I'm addressing. And I will just kind of dive right in because I know I want to make sure I'm watching my time here. I have a timer set. So let's see. So briefly, I want to talk a little bit about the perception that rural communities are primarily white is actually true, right? However, if you look at this map, you'll see that the darker the green, the higher the percentage of BIPOC community members, right? And so you'll see that although there is a concentration around the Twin Cities, we do have quite a number of rural counties with a high population of people of color. This chart shows the percentage of the population identifying as BIPOC in rural, which is the top left in a town-rural mix, which is typically the types of communities that the Center for Small Towns works with. That's top right. And then an urban town-rural mix, that tends to be more suburban areas and then entirely urban. So the rate of growth, it's hard to see from the slide, starts in 1970 and goes to 2020. So you can see the growth in communities of color in rural areas. So obviously, I mean, I think everyone will agree with this or else I wouldn't have been invited to speak today, right? But racial justice is important in rural communities. So we have in almost all rural communities, I want to do a little caveat because there are a couple that this is not, for which this is not true, but in almost all rural communities experiencing growth currently, that growth is due to an increase in the number of BIPOC folks, right? So that is mostly new immigrants, but we are looking at a new trend. There's not a lot of research about it, about folks who are choosing to come to rural Minnesota for newer, because they're needing a cheaper place to live, a safer place to live, what they perceive to be a safer place, and are making that choice. And many of those folks are actually people of color. So we're watching that trend carefully, and we haven't done a lot of research about it yet. We have, we know that 4 out of every 10 Latinx people in Minnesota are living in rural areas, and that 15,000 families with school-aged children speak 117 different languages in rural Minnesota. So this is important data just to understand the context that I'm talking about, but the context is quite different. So I want to point out a few of those differences, and CT actually, you know, touched on some of these as well, but some of the key differences that I wanted to mention are that, first of all, these communities tend to be newer. So there are not necessarily community centers or even identified community leaders who can be consulted about decisions, right? So that's really important to consider. Also, if you see a statistic like 10% of a rural community or 15% of a rural community, is people of color, it may not seem like a large percentage, but when you think about what that means for how community leaders who are mostly white, over 50, and male still in rural communities interact with these communities, even though often the intent is very positive, right? Like community leaders want to understand how their communities are changing. They want to make, to involve folks who are new to the community, but they may not have an entry point. They may not have a way to gather information from them about what their needs are, what their wants are. There are also, I don't want to sugarcoat this, right? There are cultural tensions. A lot of folks in rural communities have lived there, have generational connections, and may not be particularly pleased about the rapid change that's happened in the last 10 years in their community. That isn't true for everyone, but it is very important for community leaders to be addressing the change, to be framing it as positive, which it is, and to be thoughtful about how that unfolds. All right. So the question of what the BIPOC community living in rural Minnesota needs or wants in terms of infrastructure or public works can become a really, really focused on particular stereotypes. And it's really important to note that folks living in rural Minnesota come from a variety of cultures, ethnicities, races, religion, and social classes, and I could go on, right? So it's not a monolithic community that I can say to you, we know that people of color living in rural communities need these things, and that's very important to point out. And there are very few thorough studies that are focused on this question. So I want to talk about how, when a capital investment proposal comes to the table and you're looking at it, what happened before that, right? So one of the things that's really difficult is if you're asking a rural community to integrate the viewpoints or the interests of people of color living there, there are a lot of barriers to doing that. And I alluded to this earlier, but one of those is gaining trust. So I'll say with our MIAI program, Western Cultural Education Initiative, We spent about 3 years having an intergenerational and intercultural just listening circle where folks came to campus and talked to one another for 3 years before we actually began any research. We weren't actually intending to do research. We were having that program as just a community building program, right? But it was really important to build those relationships, to build trust, to make sure that people felt comfortable coming onto campus and getting to know our students, our faculty, and other community members who participated who were not affiliated with the university. So building trust takes a long time. There are obviously cultural and linguistic barriers to gathering input from communities of color in rural Minnesota. And we heard from many folks that they feel there is a perceived pressure from employers not to make waves. So they're hesitant often to share anything negative that they've experienced or to share even what they feel would make their lives better. That isn't true for everyone, and that dynamic has been improving, but it is definitely a dynamic that's something that we should be aware of. And I had mentioned this earlier, but again, with exceptions of places like Pelican Rapids or Long Prairie that have had longer, communities of color there a lot longer, we don't have necessarily identified community leaders or cultural centers. So leaders in small towns should be doing these things, which you can't control, right? But you can sort of, if there's a way to help rural communities to think about how assessment might happen and how capital improvement projects might incorporate the viewpoints of people of color, that would be a very positive thing. So deploying regional resources to conduct community-based research. We are, as I said, we spent some time doing that in the Morris area and are planning in this coming fall to assist other communities with similar research, which is solidarity-based research, by the way, creating relationships, actually talking to people and hearing their stories and what it is that they want, and then involving them in the solution. So, and CT kind of framed that much more eloquently than I did, but it's a similar model, right? So making time to build and grow relationships, investing in translation and interpretation in ESL classes that are aimed at encouraging participation in public life. We've really shifted some of those. We have a Tercero program, a community translation and interpretation program, and also ESL classes, and we've really tried to reframe those to be more explicitly connected to participation in civic life. And then eventually actively encouraging people to run for office, join community committees, and participate.
So, Ms. Magnolis, before you proceed, Representative Davids have a question for you. Representative Davids.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was a bit taken aback by the testifier when she started out. She said something like, and this is not a quote, I'm perfect, that she's at somewhat of a disadvantage because she's a white woman. Could she explain what the disadvantage is?
I am very sorry, sir. Yes, I am sorry. That is not what I intended to say. What I meant was I'm aware that I'm a white woman, and so I am not myself a person of color living in a rural community, and I don't want to give you the perception that things that I'm talking about are my own experience.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can see that you're a white woman. What does that have to do with anything? Is that white guilt, or what's going on here?
Oh no, I wanted to explain what my connection to the communities of color in rural Minnesota are, and so that they are based on my role in my job and not on personal experience.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair, but you know, I don't think we go around apologizing because we're white. We are what we are. We're all children of the Almighty. And so, you know, I'm not sure when I'm gonna start talking about bonding here, but I'd sure like to talk about it at some point. All of this race stuff is so divisive. It's just, I hope, Mr. Chairman, this is the last day of this.
Representative Davis, this is the, you know, the last of the racial equity hearings for this week. And, you know, we have heard from all of our testifiers about the need for us to really invest in all of our communities, especially our diverse communities throughout the state, the Black, Indigenous, people of color communities, because we have seen a history of disinvestment in these, and that's why we should prioritize this as, a committee, and because we're going to make significant investment into our state. And so, Ms. Manolis, please proceed with your testimony.
Sure. And I am getting to bonding issues here. So one of the things that the Capital Investment Committee might consider in terms of gathering input from communities of color in rural areas is to think about when you're on your tours, taking some time to get to know what is the demographic of that community and consulting with folks, a wide range of people, right? So that everyone has input in those decisions, or not those decisions, but in presenting the proposal and the benefits that that proposal might have. And just in the interest of time, I'm going to keep going here, but I'm willing to go back to any slide and give a little more information. So what I have here are, I have some slides just about different areas related to what the Capital Investment Committee does and thinking about how those might impact communities of color in rural areas. And quite truthfully, anything that's going to benefit communities of color will likely benefit all rural residents. So in terms of public infrastructure, we know that the sustainable technologies that we have here at the University of Minnesota Morris, we have quite a number of visitors from communities of color taking tours, asking questions with a lot of interest there. So there's obviously sustainable technologies are beneficial to rural communities for lots of reasons, but there is a particular interest among BIPOC communities within rural communities and those technologies. Drinking and wastewater systems are going to benefit everyone, right? So in a lot of ways, the investments that you make in rural communities will benefit everyone, but those who are most marginalized might benefit, will benefit just as much, right? So that's an important point. Rural roads tend to be the roads that are least maintained, and they're the ones used most by agricultural workers. So people who are working on agricultural land and then having to drive back home into town are using those roads, and those roads are usually the least well-maintained. So it's just something to keep in mind. And then in terms of outdoor recreation, when we did our study, one of the things we did was had families draw what they thought their ideal community would be, families of many different cultural backgrounds. And almost all of our communities of families who identify as BIPOC drew soccer fields. So that was just an interesting thing, right? So, but outdoor recreation is used by everyone. And again, investing in outdoor recreation, whether that be city parks or trails, is important for all folks in rural communities. So in terms of work, we have many empty storefronts and a real entrepreneurship spirit among BIPOC community members, but not really a lot of access in terms of how they might actually be able to start a business or sustain a business. It's a little bit outside the purview of your committee, but something to think about. There could be some creative solutions to connecting entrepreneurs to empty storefronts in rural communities. We don't want empty storefronts. We don't want to walk down Main Street and see several empty storefronts. We want those storefronts to be filled. And there's also a real need now as our communities are changing for culturally responsive businesses. So for instance, in Morris, we now have a Mexican grocery store, a Mexican restaurant, many other businesses, either businesses that are now changing their model a bit to accommodate new immigrants and other businesses that are really very much geared towards meeting the needs of new immigrants that are actually owned by Latinx folks, right? In terms of our agricultural work, folks often come here to do agricultural work for larger agribusinesses, but then they are interested in starting their own farms, but again, don't know, you know, the process for doing that or what might be involved. And then there's also this trend of farmland turning over and the next generation not wanting to take that farmland and use it. So are there some creative solutions that might work to get more immigrant farmers to farm the land, to make use of the land, and to think about producing crops that would actually benefit everybody, right? I'll say one other thing about that. There is a real need for food hubs. So farmers who are starting out need some kind of need a food hub that would get their crops to larger markets, right? So farmers markets aren't going to sustain a farm forever. And so figuring out, especially in rural communities, so figuring out how to get new farmers, get what they're producing to larger markets like hospitals or schools is really important. And then we have, in terms of housing, CT also mentioned this.
Ms. Magnolis, can you wrap up?
Sure. Thank you. So I'll just say there are, you can look at the slides at your leisure, but there are significant issues in terms of housing and transportation, access to internet that are inequitable, that have that affect communities of color and other community, marginalized communities more. We have issues with small towns not supporting renovations to schools that are needed because of an influx of immigrant communities. So paying attention to that trend is important. And I think I will just say really quickly that three takeaways, making sure that you're, when you look at proposals, you're looking at how was the needs and assessment done prior to the proposal coming to the table to you. Deciding which projects to fund should not depend solely on how many people will use the project. You want to be thinking about the projected growth in rural communities and who is sort of, that growth will involve significant growth in communities of color. And then figuring out how to provide culturally and linguistically responsive training to help people put proposals together. And with that, I will leave you. Thank you for your time. I'm sorry, I rushed through several of
these. Thank you, Ms. Magnolis. Representative Ryer, do you have a question for Ms. Magnolis, or can you wait until towards the end?
I can wait, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ryer. Next up, we have Makeda Zulu Gillespie from the Urban Research and Outreach Engagement Center. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Lee and Capital Investment Committee. My name is Makeda Zulu Gillespie. I am the Executive Director for the Robert J. Jones, University of Minnesota, Robert J. Jones Urban Research, Outreach, and Engagement Center. And thank you for allowing me to be here today. As I'm trying to share my screen.
So, Ms. Magnolis, if you could stop sharing your screen so that Makeda Zulu Gillespie can share hers. Thank you. Please proceed, Ms. Zulu Gillespie.
Thank you so much. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Wonderful.
Please proceed.
But I want to start out with talking a little bit about the University of Minnesota. I won't go on long, I promise. But the university has in place a bold public engagement agenda that is engaging its full range of resources. We are a land-grant institution, its faculty, students, and staff, its research, teaching, and outreach efforts in doing what we can to address racial inequities and systemic injustices. And while we know that race is a social construct and not real, racism is very real. The goal is to expand and deepen the youth partnership and work in three significant ways. To work better with external communities, we are in the service of all of our communities, to raise the centrality of community and public engagement within the overall work of the university, which we teach about, do research on, and outreach in, and to dedicate to both the immediate and long-term work, that there's much work to be done now, but it will take long-term dedicated commitment. The University of Minnesota Urban Research Outreach and Engagement Center was formed because the community had asked the University of Minnesota, what was it doing for the urban core? We have outreach centers in greater Minnesota, but we had no urban agenda at the time. And with that challenge and working with community, UROC was formed. It wasn't formed out of a love fest. As we've talked about, capital investment for the university was met with much hostility. People were concerned about research because of the history it had for poor people and BIPOC communities. And so they weren't exactly sure why the university wanted to come to North Minneapolis at that time. But we had lots of discussions, and it took about 3 years. We started in 2006 and actually opened our doors in 2009. So we have some experience with working with community when it's not easy, and I know you all have that same experience. The University of Minnesota UROC has three different areas that we focus on: health and wellness, community and economic development, and education and lifelong learning. And so these are a few of our signature projects that we work on, just to give you a little more background about who UROC is. We have over 60 university community partnerships. Over 50 graduate and undergraduate students go through our center each year, and over 400 participants in our critical conversations. I was glad that both C. Terrence and Ms. Margoli went before me, because we did have a critical conversation in 2019, spring 2019, talking about the rural-urban divide and trying to make sure that we are connecting with one another to build our communities, to look at the resources in both communities and exchange so that we are no longer experiencing the brain drain, that we are offering opportunities for retirement in both communities, that we're creating pathways for our young people who tend to go between the two communities, that they can do that in a more safe way, and to increase tourism in state. And so if we're wondering why capital investment is important, if for nothing else, if we're not so tied to how beautiful our community is and diverse our state is socioeconomically, economically and ethnically, excuse me, if we're just the green. So here's a little bit more about the Outreach Center. It just talks a little bit about how we want to make sure that our building is open to folks who are not doing research or interested in university activities, because that is part of making sure that we're a good neighbor and that we are invested in community. This is how we do our work. We believe in partnership that is mutually beneficial. So we don't come in to save anyone, and we don't expect anybody to come in and save us. We believe in transformation, that there are multiple ways of knowing. So academic knowledge is very important. The data that comes from the research that we gather is very important. We also know that there is much knowledge that remains in community that they can teach us. And there are different ways of doing, many pathways to get to where we need to get to, and then being transparent. It is important for us to share our information. We disseminate our information in multiple ways so that the benefit of the research is not just for the university and journals and articles and being called upon, but also so that communities can use that information for themselves to build community, as both of my predecessors talked about. We also believe that our research needs action and follow through. So it's not research for the sake of knowing just to know. We recently released our research agenda, and it's around community healing and wholeness, systems and systemic racism, individual, family, and community financial well-being. And so we just awarded three researchers to do some projects for the next year. We're very excited about that. We were nervous about talking about some of these things. We weren't sure that our community, and by community, I mean the urban core, was ready to talk about some of these things. But we find that we are right on time. So when I think about capital investment and we think about history and we think about stories, I come from a family of storytellers, so that's how I tend to talk. I think about Frogtown Green Line development. You do remember that you've already heard about Rondo and how that community was destroyed so that we could put a 94 through there, Highway 94 through there. And so when they were talking about the Green Line development, they went about it in a way where they worked with community. So instead of this this transportation coming through the community, that it would be a part of community, and how can the community benefit financially from being a part of this new investment? When the Sears Tower closed in 1994 in South Minneapolis, right off of Chicago and Lake, that was a large building, and I'm sure that we all experience when those big buildings close down, what do we do with them? We're always trying to be creative. What do we do with them? And so that became the Midtown Global Market. And that was a new way of looking at allowing smaller businesses to come together and serve a multiple of needs, whether it's food or clothing, healthy food, so not just your fast food lunch, but also groceries. But then all of those communities come together. So I was born and raised in Minneapolis, and so I remember at one point we had the slogan, the Mini-Apple. And the Midtown Global Market reminds me of the Mini-Apple. I have not lived in New York ever, but I hear of it as this multi-ethnic celebration where you can go and have many different types of experiences and get to know people. And so the Global Market is an expression of that. while putting money back into the hands of each community and all of us growing at the same time. The last and most recent development that has had a lot of excitement has been the Upper Harbor Terminal. And I am so pleased that you all decided to support that project. It's 48 acres and there hasn't been that much land available in the Twin Cities for a long period of time. It will be a generational game changer. And we've tried to be creative by involving many different communities, meaning ethnically, interest from biking, folks who want to make sure that we're having a lot of green space and access to the river, and folks wanting to make sure that we have a manufacturing space so that we can create more jobs through manufacturing and small business. The city of Minneapolis worked with a group called Urban 3 some time ago, and so it talks about the impact of investment. And what it shows here, the map that you're looking at, is that we spent a lot of money in downtown Minneapolis, and the long-term impact, as you see the cities, the area around it, is that when you invest in your tax base, that money comes back to you. This is a neighborhood area. 1937, it shows the 732 vacant lots. In 1937, those lots were, the average value was $200,000. Now, the value, well, in 2018, is $36,000. So when we think about, again, why we invest in our communities, if for nothing else, it's the return on investment. So if we look at the amount of money, if we had invested in those 732 lots, $30 million in taxes. Was lost over that 82 years. So I'm just simply reiterating these same facts, providing economic advantages for individuals, individuals and businesses strengthen the tax base. Jobs are created. Businesses benefit because of placemaking. It's the primary driver for investment. Walkability is another important factor to think about. So when we think about the urban core and we think of small towns, when people can walk to the different activities, whether it's work or play, there is some money saved on transportation, which frees up more money I see a lot of hands raised, more money to spend, which contributes to our sales tax. Compact Central Business District properties yield 10 times more tax revenue per acre than the conventional suburban development, according to Building Better Budgets. And you all have this in the packet, so you all can take a look. But I just wanted to say that I appreciate you giving me time to talk today. And the last thing that I want to leave you with is that disinvesting in communities of color, the urban core, small towns, unfortunately, does something that is intangible. A lot of times the young people in those communities who don't understand or haven't been told the history of how these things came to be, internalize that something is wrong with them and something is wrong with their communities. They believe that they just don't know how to run a business. They just don't know how to keep up a house, not understanding that there were structures in place to make sure that people didn't have money to advance themselves. So I will leave you with that. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today.
Thank you, Ms. Zulu Gillespie. And so why don't we move on to the next presentation first, and then we'll field members' questions towards the end. Next up, we have testifiers from the coalition or the group called Voices for Racial Justice. And so why don't you state your name for the record, Mr. Grant, and then proceed with your testimony, and then let me know when you're done and so I can recognize the other testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Lee, members of the committee. My name is Brett Grant, Research and Policy Director at Voices for Racial Justice. My colleague, Monica Hurtado, will start us off.
Ms. Hurtado, please state your name for the record and please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lee and members. My name is Monica Hurtado, and I'm a community organizer with Voices for Racial Justice. Our organization envisions a world without racism, that honors the culture, knowledge, power, and healing of Black, Indigenous, and people of color. So our organization has been in existence for 27 years now, and we started by offering trainings to members of the community to get the tools to be the most effective community organizers they could be. But the organization was very successful in building trust among BIPOC communities, and that made this organization a place to discuss and envision a Minnesota where we all have the opportunity to thrive. So based on the presentations we have heard today, we know about the issues of racial disparities and the opportunities to address those. So we have been very preoccupied with the how. What is the how, the processes we can create to deal with those. So we have tried several things throughout the years. In 2007, we started to release report cards. And then in 2008, we did a race equity analysis of Minneapolis school referendum that my coworker, Julia Freeman, is going to talk about in a few minutes. But then in 2009, after the crisis in the market and the impact that that had, particularly in our BIPOC communities in Minnesota, the organization started to do something that we call conversations around the kitchen table. And those conversations were about involved multiple organizations in Minnesota. We always try to work in coalition with multiple partners from the BIPOC communities and from the mainstream community as well. And those conversations with members of the community around the kitchen table about the situation of the economic crisis and how to deal with that. It led us to understand some principles that could guide decisions for the state. And out of that, we also developed a tool that we call the Racial Equity Impact Assessment. I just want to mention before I pass the mic to Shirley and Brett that we discovered many things around those conversations and throughout the years, but the principles include something very critical, and is how the solutions, the discussions to deal with these challenges need to include us. And when I say us, is the people and the communities most impacted by the racial disparities and the disparities in general. So we develop out of those conversations also the tool that we call Racial Equity Impact Assessment. And Brett, I think you can take it from there.
Thank you, Ms. Hurtado. Mr. Grant.
Thank you, Chair Lee, members of the committee. Brett Grant, what could equity investments and capital projects look like? It could look like a process of collaboration with communities who are most impacted by racial disparities and engaging with them in racial equity impact assessments of capital projects. This process would ensure that collaboratively a discussion takes place between the most impacted communities and you to address questions such as, what disparity is being addressed by a proposed capital project that comes before this committee? And what is the racial equity purpose of the project? Are there potential negative impacts by the proposed capital project? And if so, how will the proposal adjust to achieve an equitable outcome? And how will the project assess whether it can achieve its equity goals? Can the proposed capital project be sustainably successful? How? For example, how does the project ensure that adequate funding, implementation strategies, and accountability mechanisms are in place. These are just some questions that could be discussed that would lead to more questions, all of which would be answered and discussed together in collaboration. That's what equity investments and capital projects could look like. For that to happen, it means that this process of collaboration must be institutionalized and practiced in this committee and throughout the entire legislature. This kind of shared learning and civic education will not only increase access to the technical aspects of bonding, such as understanding the different types of bonds and how the agencies responsible for distributing funds do so, but also the racial equity implications of the bonding process, as well as insights into how to make the bonding process more culturally equitable. That is what we're working on to make happen in collaboration with our partners and coalitions and organizations like the Center for Economic Inclusion, to make this process of collaboration a significant part of what it means to make policy at the Capitol. Next, I want to pass it to Julia Freeman, who will share an example of how the racial equity impact assessment is being used by the Minneapolis Public School District.
Thank you, Mr. Grant. Ms. Freeman, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, my life is forever muted. Julia Freeman, I am the community Director of Community Engagement at Voices for Racial Justice. Thank you, Chair Lee and members of the community, the committee. I want to say that the racial equity impact assessment pocket guide was first created for legislators to assess their proposed legislation. And it fits easily in your pocket. I think you all received it. And for Minneapolis Public Schools, they renamed the RIA. We call it the RIA, lovingly call it the RIA, the Race Equity Impact Assessment, to be called the EDIA, the Equity Diversity Impact Assessment. And we believe that that was just easier and palatable than the word race. So the EDIA is a tool that is part of Minneapolis Public Schools Race Equity Policy 308. And this has been institutionalized in Minneapolis with the EDIA staffed community and committee. And it also has a budget. Now, all policies that impact student learning that is over $100,000 have to have an EDIA. And so it's been institutionalized so much that the Minneapolis Public School Board will ask when something is given to them, did this get an EDIA? Well, we can't move forward on this unless we see the EDIA. And it's very awesome because the EDIA committee is actually overseen by the superintendent, who is, of course, the leader of the district, but it's also in practice of equity, leadership from the top for equity, which all of you will be doing as well. And so just to let you know, it's also have been adapted in MDH for their equity assessment tool as from our RIA. The City of Minneapolis Race Equity Ordinance followed our RIA, and Ramsey County Commissioner Tony Carter had all of her department heads do a RIA for their budgets. So it's our hope that this will get institutionalized in the legislature, and equity will become the center, because this RIA puts community of color, BIPOC community, in the center as well. So you can hear directly from them when you do a RIA.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Does that conclude your remarks then?
Yes.
And then is that the concluding remarks for your presentation from Voices for Racial Justice? If that is, then we could proceed to members' questions. All right, so first on the list, we have Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So after listening to these presentations, my comments are not directed at any one presentation. It's just thoughts that I've had while going through all the presentations. First and foremost, the thought that came to my mind at the very beginning is the truth that correlation does not equal causation. That is a fundamental basic truth that each and every one of us needs to keep in mind. I can see my hand is still up, so I'll put my hand down here. That just because there's a correlation between information doesn't mean that one caused the other. And the greatest example that I could use to illustrate this fact is, it is a truth that in the summer, crime increases versus in the winter. It is also a truth that ice cream sales increase in the summer. Now, there's a correlation there, but one would be highly irresponsible to say that an increase in ice cream sales causes an increase in crime, because that we know that's not the truth. There is another variable that's not being taken into consideration. So while there's a correlation between crime and ice cream sales, there the another variable that should be added to the equation is warmer weather. In the summer months, there is warmer weather, and that is what causes then an increase in ice cream sales as well as an increase in crime. So when I'm listening to, again, these presentations, it's highly irresponsible to draw correlations between information and then to try to imply that there's a causation there. Also, when I was listening here, there has been other groups that have had been the victims and suffered great injustices. And the one I can think of is Japanese internment during World War II. They had their human rights violated, and they were forced into internment camps. So there has been an Asian discrimination in this country. There's also been a history of Irish discrimination. There's a history of Catholic discrimination in this country. But those are not necessarily on the top of the list when we're having conversations such as this, because those are not groups that have allowed themselves to perpetuate this idea that government or systemic racism or institutional racism is holding them back. Again, as I mentioned earlier in the week, the number one factor determining a person's success and outcome in life is their own decision making. That is the number one variable, not external factors. When I heard the conversation regarding zoning and homeowners associations somehow being a motivation or being motivated by racism, zoning and homeowners associations are to control land use for the benefit of the entire community. I don't want chickens in a house next to me. And I'm not saying that because I'm racist. I'm saying that because I don't want to smell the byproduct that would come from chickens, chicken coops. So if a person wants to raise chickens, then they need to move to a community or to a homeowners association that permits that. That's not a racist concept. I heard an illustration here of 700 lots in Minneapolis and something to that effect. And then I also heard a driver for homeowner or home sales as a real estate agent. Among the top factors for choosing where to live in home purchase decisions is school districts, is the school district, the quality of the school district. And we know that Minneapolis is an abysmal failure of a school district. The graduation rates are below 50%.
Representative Lucero, can you wrap up your remarks, please? So that can you wrap up your remarks so that we can move on to
other members? I'm almost done. Yep, absolutely. When it comes to purchasing a house in Minneapolis in 700 lots, I would not, and parents don't want to move to a school district that's failing. Instead, and it's not failing for lack of funding, they're among the highest funded in the state. I would want to move, and we would want to move to school districts and land that has a greater quality in education. And lastly, it doesn't matter what a person's color is, black, white, red, yellow, whatever. We all want clean air and clean water. And when it comes to bonding projects and state projects that have a regional or statewide significance, clean air, clean water, has nothing to do with a person's race. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Next up, we have Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to all of the presenters. I appreciate the broad perspectives, and I do appreciate the look at root causes and the acknowledgement of the public health crisis that racism poses to our state as a whole, to all of us, to my white community, and as well as to communities of color, because I believe all our successes are linked. At the same time, I believe that all of my colleagues here share a desire for strong communities, for the well-being of all of the people in their communities. We all love where we live and the people in them. And I want to provide the grace of assuming the same for everyone on this committee. So with that said, what I think we need to do as a bonding committee is to say, how do we use bonding to solve our pervasive issues that face our state? We need employees in our workforce. We need thriving economies. We need strong institutions. And to have that, everybody needs to be acknowledged. We cannot have a community where a white woman such as myself is assuming that I can define the problems that another community will face. I experience problems in my own way, not like someone who is Indigenous or Black or Hispanic or immigrant does, or someone who is a fellow white person living in a rural setting, because I've always lived in the suburbs or in the city. And so I extend that same humility to saying, I don't understand the dynamics of small town life in the same way a small town person does. That's one of the reasons I'm on this committee, is because I believe that as a state, we need to use our resources to strengthen our whole state. And we need to use our resources to build relationships across the state and not be fighting against each other and offering the kind of resistance that unfortunately I'm hearing here today. I would just like to end by saying to Ms. Manolis that I heard your words too at the beginning, and you did not apologize, you simply acknowledged, and I respected that and appreciated it. And if I'm gonna end with a question, it would be, what are the best practices, especially to Mr. Anderson and Ms. Manolis, that you have seen working across the state, working in rural Minnesota, small town Minnesota in particular, that towns have used to be able to build relationships between leadership and the newer communities have joined their communities? Thank you.
Sure.
So before we move on to the answer, Ms. Magnolis, but we do have Representative Erdogan Moran and Abaje on the list. And so, Representative Erdogan, I'm going to, after the testifier answer the question, go to Representative Moran, Abaje, and then you, since we did have you in before in the interest of time. So, Ms. Magnolis first, and then Mr. Anderson.
Sure, I will keep it brief. I think the big things to keep in mind are the cultural and linguistic differences that leaders and community members might have, and that may affect the way that communities talk to one another, the way that spaces are set up, the way that people are invited. And so I can't get into all of those details, but it's been a great learning experience for me to think all of those things through, to figure out why did folks show up for some meetings and not others? What are some creative ways? So I'd love to talk more, but I know we're limited on time, but it is really important to think about those differences. And I would say that funding, and this is beyond the purview of this committee, but translation and interpretation and cultural liaison services really make a big difference in making those kinds of conversations possible.
Thank you, Ms. Magnolis. And Mr. Anderson, if you could just keep your remarks short. Thank you.
Yep, I'll keep them just extremely short, and always willing to talk to more folks about our experience after this, about what we've done. But, you know, I'd say, you know, the big thing is just sort of, it's not a bad thing to acknowledge the history of these things. And I think I often find that that's the biggest challenge in doing this work is sort of people feeling like they're bad people or that they're condemning their ancestors or whatever it might be to sort of point out how we got to the present day realities. But I think ultimately that's what it takes to get a very sober and realistic research balanced view about why the disparities exist. Right there, I don't think there's things that just happened. My colleague would say we drove here and that's how we got to the place that we are today. And so that doesn't make us bad people. That doesn't make anybody's ancestors bad people. At the end of the day, it's not about people being good or bad. It's just getting a sober view so that we can do good work today. And so I think that's the challenge that I often find. And, you know, I think that's the role that Kira often plays, is to sort of destigmatize personal feelings and just sort of get to the truth of it.
Hey, Maria.
Thank you, Representative Fu. Thank you, Representative Fu, for bringing this conversation into committee today before we get to the real work that needs to be done before this body. And I just want to say, you know, discrimination in any form on any ethnicity is wrong in any form. Whether they are here making a statement now or not, it is wrong. I will also say that it is a role of government in undoing the harms from past. You know, we are a government that don't look at individuals. We are trying to solve, you know, yes, in a way about individuals, but we are trying to solve problems for communities in town across the state of Minnesota. So I just want to say to the testifiers, thank you all for presenting today. We as legislators, Mr. Anderson stated best what I was going to say, but we as legislators have a role to play to be informed. We are a more diverse legislature than we've ever been in the history of Minnesota. And so those voices of diversity comes into play to create a more fair and just state for Minnesota's, for Minnesotans. And that's our work. It's not about good or bad people. It is about making things good for all of us, not just some of us. And so I will stop there because I know he had two other folks, but thank you for this committee hearing today.
Thank you, Chair Moran, for those words. Representative Abadji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will just say quickly again to reiterate my thanks to the testifiers. All of what you have said today is completely illuminating about how we can better pursue infrastructure and investment in a manner that doesn't recreate the mistakes of the past. I think that is our purpose here today. And I appreciate you because you have given us a roadmap of how we can get to our goal, which is making sure we are no longer excluding any community from safe and stable housing, agriculture, clean water and air, transportation to jobs. So thank you guys for presenting us with these various roadmaps, these evaluation questions that we can use, because I think that will be important as we continue to get into our work of selecting the best projects to support everyone in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Abadji, Representative Erdog, and then we'll end with Representative Zhang. Representative Erdog.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do appreciate the testimony today, making us more aware of the impacts of bonding that it can have on the BIPOC community. Just some comments on Ms. Magnola's needs that she expounded upon. Okay, rural roads, drinking and water, housing, these are all important things for the state of Minnesota, but particularly for greater Minnesota that we do deal with. And we have criteria and rating, prioritizing of our drinking water systems, of our rural roads. And so we're dealing with them through a system that we have that establishes priorities, which actually doesn't take into account the racial groups being considered. Now, again, I do appreciate what's being said, but while all of this should be considered, I don't know that we're going to be able to address all needs through an equity lens. I mean, we deal with needs of the state of Minnesota. And also, I think it's very important that most of the things that we deal with are coming to us from different governmental entities, from cities. And so while it's important that we look at it maybe through a little bit different lens when we can, it's up to Minneapolis, St. Paul, cities in greater Minnesota, when they ask us for projects, to also be giving these things considerations, if that's what they think should be done. But again, we need to hear from Minneapolis. Okay, what are
Thank you, Representative Erdog. I'm sorry to cut you short. We have an opportunity on Thursday. So Representative Zhang, if you just have like a quick remark before we adjourn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick. I just want to say because you have privilege and refuse to see how systemic oppression has been designed to keep minorities as second-class peoples, let me remind you with example in which black and brown people were denied access to capital. Your ancestors were not systemically chased out of entire cities where they had their businesses burned down and firebombed and civic and business leaders not.
Mr. Chair, point of parliamentary
Thank you. Procedure. Thank you, Representative Zhang. And
not gifted.
Representative Zhang, right we can continue this conversation on next Thursday, Representative Zhang. So this meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, members.